Thank you very much, Bill. I might add there's one other point, I think, about defense spending that should be added to those which Bill has very eloquently made, and that is that every extra dollar we spend for defense is money that we are not spending for welfare. So that, our next speaker is a man I have known for more than a decade, for whom I have the highest admiration, and who is indeed a kind of Renaissance man of intellectual activity. His writings and speaking have covered almost every conceivable facet of the contemporary crisis, from foreign and defense policies, the issue we've just been discussing, to contemporary education, to the underlying philosophical causes of the many problems we confront. He is at present a professor at two different universities in New York and a visiting professor. Heresy, the counter-revolution, Sartre, and several others that are, some of which are still in preparation and will be forthcoming. His topic tonight is philosophical disorder, which is very it is a pleasure to introduce to you, for our final address of the evening, Professor Thomas Molnar.
Ladies and gentlemen, some malicious spirit suggested that the real philosophical disorder of our time is that the Philadelphia Society leaves the last 2.5 minutes to the issue of philosophy. I have reason to say, having attended the speeches of last night and of today, that all speeches and all discussions had a great philosophical dimension, a philosophical depth, and consequently, this accusation of this malicious spirit is not quite true. What I shall try to do now in this, perhaps a little more than 2.5 minutes, is that what Professor Williams did yesterday, in other words, trying to unravel the roots of philosophical disorder, but perhaps digging a little bit deeper than he had the intention of doing, all the while maintaining that one can dig yet deeper, but I shall, for reasons that will become apparent, zero in on one particular level. For to do this, I have to just very, very briefly, 1 minute out of the 2.5, give you a short rundown of what happened to philosophy, no less, in the last 300 years, after which I will proceed with the remaining 1.5 minutes to outline what has happened to philosophy just recently and in our own days. Joke aside, I think that you will agree with me that philosophy from Kant, but even from Descartes, has been unable to discover laws of nature. That is, insofar as these laws are in nature, in the outside extramental world. The assumption being that the mind, the intelligence, is unable to penetrate into the outside world, that ultimately, as Kant was to say at the end of the 18th century, we must conclude that the mind cannot receive the laws from the outside world. The mind must impose these laws on the outside world. This is a very famous and important statement of the prolegomena to any future metaphysics. And I repeat in his own words, the understanding does not derive its laws from nature, but prescribes them to nature. In other words, the mind is the one that imposes its own structural laws on nature, and what we know is not really the extramental reality of which we know very little. Perhaps it does exist, perhaps it does not. What we know is how our mind is constructed, but that is a reliable thing because all minds are constructed in the same way. Therefore, we can derive laws, but not from nature, but from our minds. It is then assumed that reality being unknowable, there is no intelligible designer behind that reality which itself is unknown or very inadequately known. That is, since it is not an intelligible reality, there is no intelligible creator or designer behind it. Therefore, the mind has every right to construct his own world. This is true not only of the natural world, which then the mind proceeds to give laws to, but also of the moral world, namely of the nature of good and evil, which are perhaps perceivable to the faithful, to one who commits himself gratuitously and without reasoning to belief, to a system of beliefs or as a religion. But this perception of the good and evil, that is of the moral law, is also not derivable from a moral reality, just as the natural law is not derivable from a natural reality. Later on, Hegel concluded from this that the only transcendental reality is the state, and Nietzsche later still concluded that the transcendental reality is of the moral order, is the morality of the Superman. That is, the man who is no longer interested in the universality of the moral law derivable from the moral world, but a part of mankind, the Superman, will impose their laws on fellow human beings, or rather lower than fellow human beings, the undermensch, the lower than Superman, who will then willy-nilly will have to follow this superimposed morality. Now, therefore, in quick order, in the 19th century, but already prefigured in the 18th, we see that objectivity, that is reality, is denied to the following entities. First of all, to God. This is already Kant's work, Kant who concludes that God is really our moral conscience, and therefore there is no transcendental God standing outside the world, but informing the world as well as our moral world. After God, the knowable creation also goes as an acceptable entity for philosophizing. Finally, the extramental reality also is denied by a variety of philosophers into whose analysis I cannot now go. And in our 20th century, but again foreshadowed by the 19th, we are now denying the correspondence of words and things which the Middle Ages defined as the adequatio rei et intellectus, that is the adequation, the correspondence of things with the intellect, because both are real, both things, extramental things, and the intellect. Hence, the intellect is able to, it was made, it was created, it was shaped by God in such a way that it should understand the outside reality and bring back reliable information from the outside reality. Now, this is also denied in such philosophies as logical positivism and the all-powerful influence on our campuses too, Ludwig Wittgenstein. There remains, therefore, since these entities have been eliminated, there remain such things as structures, as evolution, as social classes, each of them having its own way of thinking, its own reality, or rather its consensus, which takes the place of reality. There remains the gratuitous use of words, which Mr. Williams and others have illustrated by referring to movies, television shows, novels, books, and so on and so forth. There remains also libidinal energy for Freud. Ultimately, there remains the flux. That is, instead of entities which are in reality, which are not in the mind but in outside reality, there remains a flux out of which the mind tries to make some sort of a sense by imposing its own structure on this ongoing flux. Now, mind you, all this philosophy from Descartes on was conceived by the formulators to help man free his mind unclutter his mind from the varieties of accumulated superstitions, prejudices, and other things which have accumulated in the course of time. So they expected something which would be then scientific, which would be the open society in terms of society, which would be the educated men, which would be finally the liberated individual and the liberated society. Instead of that, today we have the following consequences of the philosophical disease that I have just tried very briefly to diagnose. Not only God and institutions and so on are being attacked, dogmas and such, but today there is an attack, a concentrated and systematic attack in philosophy, and this occupies the central trend of philosophizing today, on consciousness itself, which is described as false consciousness, the Hegelian term falsche Bewusstsein. There is an attack on the Cartesian cogito, which was supposed to be the essence of man. There is an attack on that, and I shall go into it very briefly in a moment. There are further attacks, and this is an escalation, you realize, on concepts, on the mere activity of the mind of conceptualizing its experiences. Experiences derived, of course, again from the outside world, but this, the outside world being denied, the mind has nothing to do with conceptualizations, because every concept that the mind would make up would be in itself false. And finally, there are attacks simply on nouns. I'm referring here to the grammatical category noun, substantive. There are attacks on that too. All these things, consciousness, cogito, concepts, and nouns, are today in modern philosophy unmasked, because the thinkers who are doing the unmasking, or decoding, if you wish, are trying to consider that cogito, consciousness, concepts, and nouns are codes hiding something more fundamental than they are. Examples. Freud decoded God, father, family, and such concepts, and found underneath these concepts, underneath these realities, the unconscious, itself consisting not of an entity, not of something, but of libidinal pulsions. That is another name that Freud gave to this underlying flux, libidinal pulsions. So all concepts liquidated, and underneath the flux, which in Freud's terminology are libidinal pulsions or bundles of drives, if you wish to give it another name. Darwin decoded also the primacy of man as the centerpiece of creation, as the centrality to whom God had entrusted, as it says in the Bible, the stewardship of nature and, as it were, the crowning achievement of creation. Darwin decoded the primacy of man and found underneath the movement, the flux of evolution. Nietzsche, perhaps one of the chief decoders, decoded the Hebrew-Christian Socratic morality and found underneath the will to power, which is again not an entity, it is an ongoing will, it can never in a way find satisfaction, just as libidinal pulsion cannot find satisfaction, and just as evolution is endless, or perhaps even aimless, and therefore Nietzsche also finds that the will to power is that underlying flux. Marx decoded the state and society and social classes and found underneath the economic interests. The economic interests which explain why a particular class, a particular society, and a particular state are trying in their own way to conceptualize the flux, in other words, to become reactionaries by stopping, by arresting the underlying economic interest whose historical mission would be and will be the establishment of the classless society, itself, of course, an endless project in itself. And therefore, all these things like state, society, and classes for Marx are, in reality, also conceptualizations, ways of arresting this constant flux, this constant movement. And finally, and perhaps most recently, there is the German Protestant theologian, Rudolf Bultmann, who decodes Christianity that was missing from this tableau. After decoding man, that is his primacy, decoding God as father, and decoding other social institutions like the family by Freud, after decoding the Hebrew Christian morality and Socratic rationality or reasonableness and consequent morality. Do not forget that Socrates plays a very important role in our Western morality, rather suffer injustice than inflict it. This is already the Christian idea of morality. That is also decoded and found underneath that will to power is the explanatory factor of all these supposed realities, all these masks that society and men wear and which the modern philosopher must decode. Then, as I said, there came Rudolf Bultmann, who in his own words demythologized Christianity, but in a sense we can say that the demythologization is an act, is a work of decoding, of unmasking. Because he too, in his own theological idiom, finds that the sacred, such as, for example, the sacraments, are not real ways for man's salvation. Oh, this is, of course, this has a long history in Christianity. After all, Luther himself has already diminished the number of sacraments and attributed to faith a salvific value, an exclusive salvific value. But Bultmann goes, of course, far, far beyond that and radicalizes this whole teaching by saying that what is objective in Christianity, and what is objective in Christianity? Jesus Christ and the sacraments which he has commanded that we observe. The way Bultmann proceeds is by saying that, of course, Jesus Christ may or may not have been a historical figure, but that is an unimportant issue. The important issue that there was such a thing, not historically, but there was such a thing as incarnation. Whether this was actually Jesus Christ who became incarnate, that is not the issue. The issue is that there is an incarnation, and each time that man, the believer, the Christian, makes a decision, makes, of course, a dramatic, decisive decision, chooses Christ, to use a fundamentalist term, there is an incarnation taking place in him. That is, in his soul, there are as many incarnations as there are decisive, dramatic, radical decisions. Bultmann was not the first to say that. The 15th century Catholic Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa said already the same thing, namely that in man's soul is the childbed of Christ. Each time man makes a decision, Christ is born anew in the human soul. Compare that to what Kant said in his own almost completely secularized idiom, namely that the consciousness is God, and God is in the consciousness. So Bultmann builds here on a long tradition, as indeed all these men, they just find new applications and especially new terminology. But when Bultmann says that the historical existence of Jesus Christ is neither here nor there, that this is not the issue, he may or may not have existed. In fact, he may or may not have been really, really God. But the important thing is that there was such a phenomenon as Jesus Christ, and after him, each time that man makes a decisive religious decision, there is incarnation taking place in him. This is decoding, demythologizing, in his own words, the historically, existentially existing Jesus Christ. And then the sacraments, which are also objective existence, also have their extra mental role to play. They are also not sacred anymore in this concept because they too are reduced to the sacrament that is being achieved, accomplished within man with this new incarnation each time he makes a decision. So therefore, Bultmann decodes, and this is perhaps one of the most important things, because the theological, religious contribution to modern-day philosophy should by no means underestimate it. This decoding, this demythologizing is perhaps the ultimate that the demythologizers or unmaskers could do. Now, we are told by Paul Ricoeur, who is teaching half-time at the Sorbonne and half-time here at Chicago at the University of Chicago Department of Religion. We are told by Paul Ricoeur that the philosopher from now on must be suspicious. And this is a quotation. The philosopher must become a suspicious man of consciousness because consciousness fabricates, as I said, masks. Consciousness fabricates illusions. And even what we call, or what Descartes called, evidence, or what Kant called still, with some remnant of the reality, of the recognition of reality as true discourse, all these are illusions, as are indeed, in the Heideggerian vocabulary, all images are also illusions. Heidegger says that when we think that we know something, in other words, we have that experience that Descartes described as clear and distinct ideas, that is evidence. For Heidegger, these are images that we then have, an image in the mind, which we seem to recognize. But basically, these images are in the mind. Therefore, by recognizing them and by satisfying our search for evidence, we are again just mystifying ourselves, because neither evidence, nor rationality, nor true pictures can be called the ultimate rock-bottom reality. So that the suspicious philosopher should turn into the questioning philosopher, not in the sense of free examination and scrutiny of all ideas that come before us, but the philosopher should constantly question everything that he seems to know, should even question himself, because each time that there is an answer, that he is tempted to give an answer, he must give that answer in terms of images, of evidences, or at least of concepts, ultimately of concepts. But all concepts are illusions, and we can start this whole process again. All concepts are codes to be decoded. All concepts are masks to be unmasked. Consequently, each time we say God, or moral law, or social class, we are universalizing unduly or irresponsibly something which is in the flux. We separate from the flux one particular point, one particular stage. We conceptualize it. We call it by some name. And thereby, we have falsified the whole philosophical enterprise, the whole philosophical quest. Just remember here for a moment that one of the first things that man is supposed to do in Genesis is to, in the Bible generally, is to give names to objects and to animals. In other words, man is supposed to name things because these things that he names are actually what he will name them. In other words, names are not just a consensus operation. It is not a conventional operation. Names do coincide, do correspond to reality, and I quote to you again the medieval assumption of adequatio rei et intellectus, that every word corresponds to a reality. This is already the Bible, the biblical philosophical message, so to speak. This entire tradition is not only from Descartes on, but from the Bible on and from Socrates on, denied by the modern philosophy. After all, what does Socrates do? Very much what the Bible did. Names things, clarifies concepts, calls things by their name and questions people as long as they come up with his own midwifery with the right name for things. Now you see then, you can measure what happens today to philosophy when all this is being denied and the flux replaces the noun. So therefore, the new philosophy deprives men of God's paternity, of reliance on such things as consciousness, evidence, and the cogito, the I think. In the moral order, it deprives men of the moral imperative, of the knowledge of good and evil. we are left with pulsions, libidinal and social dynamics, or activism in everyday parlance, and we are not allowed to let these flux things, these moving things, to coagulate into anything like concepts, like valid representations, like knowledge, like moral judgment, and like God. Instead of that, we have turned the flux into self-sustaining systems, Teilhardian evolution, the flux of changing values, changed relationships. We are told every day, and I unfortunately see that even conservatives subscribe to this subtle device of their opponents when they say we live in a revolutionary time and everything changes and mutation and all that. We are merely then subscribing to the flux theory that the relationship between men and women has radically changed or is changing. The relationship between father and son is radically changing. We introduce such concepts as generation gap. Of course, there is no generation gap. There has always been a certain misunderstanding, just as naturally, between men and men, between father and son. But when we say generation gap, we are subscribing to the theory according to which the past is bad because it has coagulated into concepts, and even generations are concepts. There is a gap then, and after the gap, well, of course, there will be biologically new generations, but they will not be generations. They will be a new world. They will represent something entirely new. And of course, we have then, ultimately, utopian projects. A friend of mine, professor at the University of Strasbourg, lately had a conversation or a debate with Dominicans, French Dominicans, who said to him that ultimately what counts is that we should have, instead of politics, we should have utopian projects. And when he answered them, yes, but why should I subscribe to your utopian project? Maybe it is a kind of a blank check that you want me to sign, and that why should I not have my utopian project? Then, of course, it was called a reactionary. So what we see then as a result of all this, that there is no final commitment today. And I try to show you now that what we have in everyday life, when young people deny the perpetuation of their relationships to job, to people, to parents, Patricia Hearst, or divorce laws or abortion and so on, that in a way we are subscribing subtly but increasingly, led by this philosophy of the flux, to the abolition of final commitments. Jesuits told me in various places in the world that it is impossible to get young Jesuits because they would subscribe perhaps to or would sign up for a few months, for a few years, but they say, well, then another commitment may await me, which is a deeper commitment. Again, there is no conceptualization and there is no commitment in practical everyday life. The Chicago Seven, one member of it, I think it is Jerry Rubin or one of them, was member of that organization today. Tomorrow he is committed to the guru, whatever his name is. In other words, an endless openness, an endless availability to the calling, not of course of any reality, because any reality would be a conceptualized reality and therefore would be a mask, which we must unmask, but we commit ourselves to the ultimate reality because there is always a God to which we commit ourselves, and that is the self, our own self, which already is evident in Kant. So that the important thing is to project oneself, as Sartre said, consequently to build one's personality, but not to trust anything which is outside the personality. And while not allowed to be to conceptualize reality, we are constantly projecting ourselves. Look at the etymological meaning here, throwing ourselves ahead of ourselves, so that we should never be ourselves, because even the ego, as it is now, is in the danger of being coagulated, of being conceptualized. Therefore, the ego itself becomes a kind of a flux. We face there, therefore, the discourse on which philosophy rests, namely discourse of substantives. Not only, I'm not speaking of substantive issues, although the term is rightly chosen, I'm speaking of nouns, we are supposed to reject any kind of substantivization, any kind of speaking in terms of nouns, and the self then remains the only, not reality, but the only thing to which we can still commit ourselves, and this self then becomes a kind of imperialistic self. It makes conquests all in the extramental world outside it. It absorbs everything like an insatiable Moloch, and it becomes, therefore, the residue both of the outside world and of the inner God. And therefore, the self is elected to the highest position, that of God. The self is self-building. In scholastic terminology, it is assé, that is, depending exclusively on itself, not deriving its existence from any outside agent, such as, for example, a God. We are not using the term to be. We are not. We are becoming. As, again, Ricoeur says, and this is an interesting development out of this, the atheist is the man, therefore, who is the believer. Because the believer, by having objectivized or conceptualized God, is at the same time alienated from himself. He has projected himself unnecessarily into an outside agent, who is God, and therefore he has, in a way, betrayed the whole idea of God. The real man who is still believer, who is a religious spirit, is the atheist. Because the atheist, by definition, rejects God as a concept, as a reality, rejects institutions, and rejects any kind of conceptualized doctrines. He works for a new absolute, because man always wants an absolute, and projects ultimately another absolute. But that absolute is, in Ricoeur's description, a faith-hope absolute, that is an open-ended absolute, which, however, in our present day, in the practical order, exemplifies itself as social-political improvement. And I quote from Ricoeur, "The new faith opens on a new creation. It is less centered on subjective salvation than on social and political justice." I think with this, we can understand why the clergymen of today, from Pope down to Dominicans, Jesuits, Protestant clergymen, and so on, have accepted, subscribed to, and are promoting the social gospel. Because that is the new religion, and it is not just a whim, it is not just a teaching of here and there a maverick theologian. It follows from the whole body of philosophy as it has increasingly narrowed down and zeroed in on this present-day demasking, demythologizing, unmasking. Now, in conclusion, just a question. There are two possibilities that are now available to this kind of philosophy. Either it constitutes itself into a new church based on faith as openness, in which case it might turn into a new fundamentalist kind of a religion, like Quakerism or Jehovah's Witnesses, in which everybody can feel and sense the call anytime, and his expression in his own idiom of the call of the self is as valid as anybody else's. That is one possibility for this new philosophy. The other possibility is that it will develop its own conceptual discourse. Then, however, it must discard the theory that concepts are nothing but masks. Because even the statement, "concepts are nothing but masks," is a highly conceptualized statement. Therefore, this philosopher must also understand that human beings cannot overstep the ways and forms of human intelligence, which is a conceptualizing operation, that they remain within its limits even while denying the basis and validity of this statement. So this new philosophy has no other choice than to make a new alliance with reason. Not before then will the present philosophical disorder find a satisfactory solution.